from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks for the two Johnnies. It's Thursday, the 18th of May, and this is Game On. Coming up today, it's day one at the second major of the golf season. Greg Allen has the latest. In boxing, Katie Taylor faces the press today ahead of Saturday's big fight in Dublin. Aoife Murray and Rebecca Cray are standing by on busy news week in camogie and women's soccer. And in rugby, Leinster's Hugo Keenan tells me how he went from the under-14 D team to the Champions Cup final.
That under-14s, playing for that D team, I suppose I never dreamed of playing for Leinster. I was always going to matches and supporting Ireland, but it was just constantly, I suppose, tipping away, working hard, just going from team to team and just trying to enjoy it along the way. So hopefully a good message for any young kid out there who does dream big, to just keep tipping away and keep working hard. So I suppose you just got to use that in a positive way.
If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Welcome along. I'm delighted to say that Rebecca Cray is with me in studio listening to Hugo Keenan there. Rebecca, he's saying, just keep tipping along. Things might work out for you. And then I watched Man City last night against Real Madrid and thinking that those kids, those guys were, when they were kids, were probably in academies. If they hadn't made it by the time they were 13, 14, I'd say they were totally written off. Haaland had been earmarked. Every decision that was made along the way was with what he's doing now in mind. And I'd say they're all probably the same. I was lucky enough to be in the Etihad last night for the Real Madrid and Man City game, and Man City were absolutely awesome, Rebecca.
Unbelievable. Yeah, I think we were speaking before we came on air, you know, just like they just made Madrid look average at times, completely relentless in how they approached the game. I think from minute one, they just came out the blocks flying, you know, and the atmosphere, and you were obviously witness to it, like, was something I don't think I've ever heard, and in the Etihad especially, like, so.
Yeah, no, it was great. It was a bit different now. Like, I've been at a lot of big European games in Anfield and watching Liverpool, in the likes of, I've been to Roma and Bayern Munich games and Barcelona, but it was still a really good atmosphere there. Liverpool fans are just maybe a little bit different, but it was great. And like you mentioned it there, them coming out of the blocks, and I described it earlier as it was like a power surge. Like, it was completely compelling. Yeah. I didn't look at the clock until the 42nd minute. You know, you might glance up,
but yeah,
there was so much going on with them on the pitch. Like, just the amount of work that they were doing everywhere. Like, there was just constant movement. They were trying to get the ball into Haaland at all times. The tracking was just, like, in comparison to Real Madrid, like, just the way that that Silva and Grealish were getting up and down the pitch, and if you were to compare him to Vinny Jr. or to Rodrigo, there was just no comparison. Same with Benzema, he just didn't seem to have that movement in around the box. They just seemed to be overrun and overloaded all the time, and like, even the second half at stages, it looked like there was four or five City players around the ball.
Yeah, like Kroos or Modric just weren't.
They weren't. They weren't able to make any impact at all. Like, it was so strange to see it, and even like, usually when you're looking at Modric, he looks like the conductor of the orchestra. Yeah. He looks like a shadow of himself. Like, he looked almost, it's almost like he shrunk a little bit.
Yeah. Just around giant stuff, but that's what it looked like through the whole game. You know, as you said there, they just completely stretched the defence down the wings, you know, and it was an onslaught, to say the least. And Pep doesn't stop on the sideline either, you know, just demands that level of work rate. And
out of possession, like the work that they were doing out of possession, like to see what they were putting in. And also, look, the physique, like, Jack Grealish was in front of me for the first half on that left side, and like, just the strength of him. And I saw his calves. Yeah, it was quite close to them. But like, I thought that, I had a perception that maybe he was a little bit slighter, a little bit smaller, and not at all. Like, he's just, and he's able to just stand up and hold the ball for such long periods of time, and the strength to hold
just that core strength.
And obviously, players know as well that there's no point trying to go at him, because he is able to hold players off. And then Haaland, it was like a fighter jet. When he starts to go, like, he is just, he ramps it up, and the acceleration and the ground that he can cover.
So powerful.
Yeah, it was an experience watching them being so good and being able to execute the game plan. And even just watching Pep Guardiola and Carlo Ancelotti at the lines and the different body languages and,
yeah,
you know, Pep being so dramatic, and but in a way then Ancelotti was just totally lost. He didn't know what to do. He couldn't find...
Helpless, yeah.
Yeah, he couldn't find a way out of it. I thought maybe in the second half when it was 2-0 that they might get one, and but, I mean, very quickly it was the realisation.
I think if it wasn't for Courtois, it could have been a lot more.
Oh
as
my
well.
Gosh, yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic, like a cat at times. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was one of those things where, like, you were out of your seat all, like, regularly, because there were so many dramatic mm-hmm. moments, so many close calls
yeah.
that if he hadn't been in the goals, like, who knows what the score might have been. But it was a really good experience. I must say I enjoyed being there to witness good. It. Of course, there are a lot of questions about the financial fair play, and Miguel Delaney has been brilliant about highlighting it, and he wrote an article in the Independent today detailing some of the issues surrounding this Manchester City team and maybe what it means for the future as well. It's well worth reading, because you couldn't help but just be in awe of the quality that they have, like even bringing on Julian Alvarez at the end. Like in any other team, you've got somebody of his calibre,
yeah.
and even Foden as well, you know,
that, like, true ball for the last yeah. goals.
To see
immense.
Them,
yeah.
they have so much depth, and they're not going to go anywhere. And there's a good stat doing the rounds as well that since that financial fair play issues came to light in early February, City have been unbeaten in every competition. So clearly they themselves are not thinking about it too much. Right, we're going to park that now, and we're going to turn our attention to the golf, because it is a really big day, the opening day of the US PGA, and I'm delighted to say that Greg Allen joins us. Greg.
Hi, Marie. Yeah, it's been an interesting, somewhat underwhelming day, but still interesting, because the Irish number one on the leaderboard, so to speak, is a man who won this championship in 2008. We wouldn't have expected Paddy Carrington to be the best of Rory McIlroy, Shane Lowry and himself on the course, but he is. And Paddy Carrington is playing some of the best golf that we've seen for many years, really, and consistently doing so. A man who won four times on the Champions Tour last year is tied 13th on the leaderboard. He just birdied the 10th hole just a few moments ago, 146-yard wedge into just 3 feet, and he tapped that one in, and that just offset the bogey that he made on the third. So Paddy Carrington is level par after 10, and that's good going, because this is playing like a US Open-like course, so par is a really good score. It's a par 70 course here at Oak Hill in Rochester. We're just 5 miles from Lake Ontario, near the Canadian border, so it's fairly far north. It's not a very warm day, but it's now a mild day, having started with a frost delay of nearly 2 hours, and Harrington obviously revelling here in what are very, I suppose, Irish climactic conditions. So he's going nicely, just 2 shots off the lead. The leaders, incidentally, on 2 under par are Ryan Fox, the Irish Open runner-up back in 2018 and back up in Ballyliffin, and Sahith Tagala, also on 2 under par, and they lead a large group on 1 under par, which includes the defending champion Justin Thomas and the world number 2 Scotty Scheffler, and a former champion Keegan Bradley also in that group on 1 under, Bryson DeChambeau in that group on 1 under. So really tightly bunched at the top 12 players, only separated by just the 1 shot. And then comes Harrington, 2 off the lead on level par, tied for 13th. Now, Rory McIlroy obviously is a man with a big gallery around him. He's not going well at all. He's got this thing called a two-way miss going on, which means that the ball is going right off the tee, and sometimes he overcompensates and flips his hands over and tries to compensate for the ball going right, and the ball has gone left as well. So he's missed 2 fairways so far by a long way right, and on the 10th hole, his 10th hole just a few moments ago, he hit it left. So that is a familiar problem for him. It's not a nightmare problem. He has solved it before. Whether he can solve it by the end of today's round is another question. Hopefully by the end of the week he does. Hopefully he has a weekend. But he's not playing particularly well. Missing fairways and greens. Just 1 fairway hit in 10 holes. His run really began in terms of making drop shots. 5 pars to start with. On his 6th hole, he found a bunker short of the 15th, a long way short of the pin. So that must have been a mishit from the tee, and he left it 9 feet away, and that was bogey. He then bogeyed, hit his 8th hole, where he missed the fairway by 40 yards. On his 9th hole, on the 18th, it's, because he teed off in the 10th, it's a very tough par 4, and he also hit that one right. But as I said a few moments ago, it went left off the tee. So he is struggling, there's no question about it, and he's 3 over par after 10 holes. Not so much better for Shane Lowry, who's 2 over after 9. He started started quite well, four straight pars, and then on a short par four, the 14th, where he would have expected a great chance of making birdie, he drove the ball into a front right bunker and then thinned the bunker shot off over the back of the green, which is a nightmare. It just it's the leading edge of the club catching the ball, and the ball went way over the green. He did really well to make bogey there. He got himself into a real tangle, but was happy to walk off with a five, if happy is the right word when you make bogey, but certainly it could have been worse. So Shane Lowry, two over after nine. Rory McIlroy, three over after 10. Cody Harrington, though, just two off the lead on level par. John Rahm was up on the leaderboard. He was birding his first hole, which was a great start, the world number one, but he went back-to-back bogeys on his seventh and eighth holes. So John Rahm back on one over par, but that is only three shots off the leaders, and they are Ryan Fox and Sahith Theegala, both on two under.
Greg, just on Harrington, you've obviously been following him his whole career. Does he have it in his locker to be able to consistently perform for the next few days at this level?
Oh, Harrington has said clearly that he's playing, in terms of hitting the golf ball, he's playing as well probably as he has. Now, he doesn't always glue it together at this level of the game, because he plays in the Champions Tour a lot. But Harrington was fourth in the USPGA Championship, this very championship, 2 years ago in Kiawah Island, on one of the longest courses. In fact, it was actually statistically the longest course ever to stage a major championship. So Harrington has plenty of length. To get into a little bit of statistical technical issues, his swing speed is 120 miles an hour with the driver. That means the driver head passes the golf ball at 120 miles an hour. And that's the highest he has ever achieved in his life in tournament golf. And that means that at 51 years of age, he's playing probably in terms of his ball striking ability as well as ever. His putting is pretty solid, having had the yips for a while, and you always have the yips when you have them. It's almost like an indefinable nervous thing which can afflict even the best players in the world. But he's overcome that, and he won four times last year on that Champions Tour, and he's had a top 10 finish in the Valero Texas Open already on the PGA Tour this season. So he's not wanting for length off the tee. He says himself, if he gets his head in the right place, which it might just be, level par after 11 now, he might just have a chance of becoming the oldest major champion in history. Phil Mickelson earned that title at 50 years of age when he won at Kiawah Island 2 years ago.
And Greg, when you're playing in the Masters like he is there no pressure on him now? Just psychologically, is he in a place where, can we say free shot? Is that appropriate?
No, it's not, because I think when Padraig gets his head into the game, he feels he's a player who can win, and he doesn't feel necessarily that he's one of the players in the field making up the numbers who'll be doing well to have a shot at winning. He believes if he gets into contention that he can win. And, he did show that to some degree in Kiawah Island 2 years ago. He was 48 in Kiawah, 40, yeah, he was actually 49 in Kiawah Island 2 years ago. So, if Harrington had won at Kiawah Island 2 years ago, he would have been the oldest major champion in history. It turned out the 50-year-old Phil Mickelson won. Harrington believes he can win. He doesn't believe it's kind of a free shot. When he gets into the mix, he feels he's the same as anyone else. But it's getting into the mix, getting into the position on Sunday, see where you are after nine holes of the final round on Sunday. And if he should be there, he'll believe he can win.
Right, okay. Well, that's exciting, isn't it, Greg?
It is. And by the way, as recently, and it's not that recent, 2015, it's 8 years ago. Okay, so he was 43 years of age. He was tied for the lead in the Open at a time when his game didn't look all that good, and maybe he didn't have as much self-belief back then. I think he's a better player now than he was in 2015 at 51.
Okay, well, we're going to be keeping an eye on that now over the next few days. Greg, thank you so much. We'll actually check in with you a little bit later on as well. We're going to turn our attention now to boxing, though. So much build up to this Katie Taylor, Chantelle Cameron fight in the Three Arena on a Saturday evening. It's been brilliant to see her getting so much attention, to see so much positivity around her home, Katie Taylor's homecoming. Obviously, there are a few shadows lingering, but so far we've seen a lot of Katie front and centre. We're getting to hear from her. We're getting to see her working out. She was in Dundrum the other day, sparring with a little girl, and it's nice just to see her getting so much coverage, and she's been doing her fair share of talking to the media as she was today. Let's hear from her.
Yeah, this is absolutely incredible. We're only 2 days away from making my homecoming fight. I think one of the things that I wanted to achieve when I first turned pro 6 years ago was to fight here at home. And this is a nation who loved their sport, who loved their boxing, and you know, for a very, very small nation, we're very good at it as well. So it's amazing to be bringing big time boxing back to this nation again, where it belongs. And this isn't any normal fight. This is undisputed champion versus undisputed champion. This is a very, very special fight, one of the biggest fights in boxing, I believe. I think we're definitely turning a new leaf for Irish boxing. We hopefully this is the first night of many nights here at home in Ireland. And even looking at the public workout today, just looking at so many young fighters there, young girls who are watching the public workout, they're looking up to myself and Chantel and all these other fighters. It's absolutely fantastic. It's great to be in a position where you're actually influencing the next generation of fighters, and they're going to grow up with big dreams, big ambitions as well, which is absolutely amazing. When I was growing up, you know, as a 9 or 10 year old, having these big dreams, you know, I didn't have the Olympics at the time, and we had so many obstacles, so many boundaries in the way, but here we are making the path so much easier for the next generation of fighters. And it's amazing. You know, just a few hours ago, I met up again with Deirdre Gogarty, who was my hero growing up. She was the only female fighter I actually knew of at the time. And just the influence that she had on my career, it's amazing that I could be that for some young girl coming up in the sport as well.
Well, Katie Taylor is definitely that for a lot of young girls, and not just in boxing, and boys as well, in many different sports. And one of them, Rebecca Craig, that she played to such a high level, and who knows, maybe if it was a different time, she'd be one of those players been heading off to Australia in a few months. But you played with her, against her, encountered her?
Yeah, I would have been like within squads, you know. I was only very, very young at that stage, you know, in Irish squads, played in some friendlies with her. You know, she was just one of them physical players. I played against her a few times. She would have played for St. Catharines at the time. Mm-hmm. I was at Temple Oak myself, but she was just rock solid. And I remember in a warm-up game or a warm-up for the Irish team, I think it was on the team against her, I went to shoulder, just splat on the ground, you know. She's just so, so strong. Didn't score many goals, but she was just really, really tough and athletic. And the goals she did score were absolute crackers. So
she gave an interview to Peter Carroll this week, and she spoke actually quite a bit about football. And it was interesting just to hear her even say that she wasn't that goal scorer, as you mentioned there. She said those two goals she scored for the Irish team were the ones that seem to keep popping up on the time on the internet. But he asked her whether she'd ever leave or ever wanted to leave boxing for football, and it was never a question. She loved boxing so much more, and she enjoyed football, and definitely she got loads of friends from it and all the rest. But for her, boxing was what she was, I guess she probably feels like that's what she was born to do. It was her passion. She loved the individual aspect of it. It was her favorite sport. She, and you know, just from following her over the years, she had said in this interview that she liked that she's never relying on anyone else to show up or put the work in, and just given the dedication.
It's all on her shoulders.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like, she carries that. Like, that's the. She like, when it comes to discipline, training, working hard, like, she epitomises all of that. I could imagine that she would have been very frustrated at times
in a team sport. Yeah,
big time. Yeah, whereas she controls definitely everything in the individual sport. But yeah, we'll see how she goes now on Saturday. I'm heading along, so it should be a good one. I know some tickets are starting to pop back up though, on the resale on Ticketmaster, so anyone that is looking for one, do keep an eye out, because I think it's going to be another fantastic night watching Katie Taylor. And let's be honest, there aren't too many of them left, so when we can go and see her, she's worth going to see for
definitely
sure. Okay, we're going to take a break. Stay with us though, we have lots more to come. I caught up with Hugo Keenan and Dan Sheehan ahead of Leinster's game against La Rochelle, so do stay tuned for that.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. It's time to turn our attention to rugby. There's a huge Champions Cup final taking place this weekend ahead of the Katie Taylor fight. It's going to be a busy Saturday in Dublin for sure. Leinster welcoming La Rochelle to the Aviva Stadium. Leinster searching for that fifth star. Hugo Keenan and Dan Sheehan were available to the media for interviews last week. I spoke to both of them, and I spoke to Hugo particularly just about his career and how he went from being on that under 14 D team to now trying to get the Champions Cup win against La Rochelle this weekend.
Game on.
Rugby. What is so special about playing at home and having that crowd in the Aviva?
I suppose it's just the amount of family and friends that are there. I suppose one of my favourite bits is after the game, luckily if we win or lose, just doing that lap. It was very special in the Six Nations, winning the Grand Slam and at home in front of so many familiar faces, and you recognise people in the crowd, and seeing aunts and uncles and cousins, and then your parents and close family as well, is really cool. That I suppose they don't have to travel too far, and even in game as well, it's the excitement and buzz that we're lucky to be having the home advantage, and hopefully it'll be the same this weekend with a big crowd out there and lots of Leinster fans.
What's that crowd feel like? You mentioned the energy there. Like, what can you describe it?
Like, it's any line break, it's any big moment, I suppose, they get behind you. When the games are real tight, I suppose, against Ulster, against Leicester, it was very close at stages, even when we went down to Toulouse as well. So these big moments, the crowd cheering you on, it just drives you, whether it's to hit that extra ruck, to sprint that bit harder, to concentrate a bit more, because the pressure is on. But it adds to the whole atmosphere and the whole experience for us players, and does make it really special.
So beating New Zealand, winning a Grand Slam, hopefully a Champions Cup, is there a hierarchy for you in terms of the achievements, or are they all just next one, next one?
Well, for me, it's the next one is the European Cup, I suppose. I've lost a final last year, a semi-final the year before, and a quarter-final the year before that. So they're my three experiences in European rugby, and that's the pinnacle of the club career, and that's been at the forefront of my mind, and that's the sole focus at the moment, because you want to get that fifth star, you want to be involved in those teams. I suppose I look back to 2018 when I wasn't involved, when I was in my third year academy, I suppose part of the wider collective, but didn't get any game time. I was off with the sevens for a bit, and a lot of my friends who I've came through the ranks with, like Port and James Ryan, were there and have won one, and I suppose it's just driving me on more to get one myself and get that fifth star for the whole group.
Sometimes it feels almost surreal that you guys haven't won one in so long, and that your generation, so many of the guys from your era haven't got one, haven't got a star.
It just, I suppose, shows how tough of a tournament it is, and like the range of quality. Like, the French teams have obviously pushed on recently, but the addition of the South African sides have made it extra competitive, and knockout rugby's it's so tough, and it can be so cruel, and we've come so close, so we're leaving no stone unturned, and it's going to be an exciting challenge for us this weekend, but we're not going to be short of motivation.
Learning's the word is sometimes such a cliche, but at the same time, the fact that you have lost those big games, particularly last year's final, what are your takeaways from that?
I suppose, like, on a personal level, I don't think I performed in last year's final, so I suppose getting individually myself right for that, there's a few small things I've worked on over the last year, from learnings, not only in that game, but a few losses that we did take, and then collectively as well, we've looked back at the final, and you've just got to use those experiences to drive you on. You can't really dwell on it too long, but just to use that as that extra bit of motivation, extra bit of determination to go one step further this year.
So what did you work on in your game?
A lot. I suppose my kicking game, I didn't feel I was a world-class kicker, and still a bit to go. Even ball skills, handling skills, I think something Stuart and coaches in Ireland have encouraged, I suppose, the whole back line to get your hands on the ball a bit more, helping out tens, varying the point of attack, and then we've got a good few things, I suppose, from a team perspective as well, which we need to fix up, because Arishel are a top side. They've proven it over the last few years, and are right up there in the top 14, and obviously have been shown in Europe as well. So we'll need to be on our game to beat them.
You seem to always be favourites in every game that you go into. Is there pressure on you guys to deliver consistently all of the time, and how do you feel about that, if there is?
I suppose you just have to harness it and use it in a positive way. Like, we like to say pressure is a privilege, and it's about using it to your advantage, and it just means you're in a playing in important games that have something on the line, and that's an exciting thing for any rugby player or anyone to be involved in. So yeah, there's going to be a bit of pressure this week, but these are the weeks you want to be involved in and the games you want to be playing in, and they really test you, so that's exciting.
There's a lot of interest in your story, your I guess your journey to being an international player, the fact that you weren't the prolific 14-year-old. It took you a while to get going. Are you surprised how many people are interested in that?
I suppose if it can be a bit of encouragement and motivation for any kid growing up, I think that's what I take from it, I suppose. At under-14s, playing for that D team, I suppose I never dreamed of playing for Leinster. I was always going to matches and sport in Ireland, but it was just constantly, I suppose, tipping away, working hard, just going from team to team, and just trying to enjoy it along the way. So I suppose it's just hopefully a good message for any young kid out there who does dream big, to just keep tipping away and keep working hard. So I suppose you just gotta use that in a positive way.
What would it mean for you to win this game against La Rochelle?
Like, as I said, it's the pinnacle of European rugby. It's something I haven't achieved. It's been at the forefront of my mind when I'm in Leinster camp for the whole year and over the last few years. So to do it in front of the home support, in front of family and friends, would be incredibly special. So yeah, really looking forward to it now.
Do you take confidence from the Grand Slam?
I suppose a small bit. You have to use that momentum, but yeah, you have to. You can't really rest on your laurels. Ireland and Leinster are very separate in their own rights, and I suppose we're coming off two tough defeats last year for Leinster, and that's really what's driving us on in here. But I suppose you can use a bit of the momentum with Ireland, with Leinster over the last few weeks to drive us into this weekend.
Now, that was a Leinster player, Hugo Keenan, speaking there. I also spoke to Dan Sheehan and I asked him about how he feels about losing to La Rochelle last year, and he also spoke about playing in the AIL.
Game on. Rugby.
There's a lot of talk about the AIL after the recent final and how much it can be a platform for players to go on and potentially get contracts. Was that what you found along the way?
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm a massive fan of the AIL. I played three full seasons, two with Trinity, one with Lansdowne, and I thought, you know, the standard that is being played each week is huge, and I think it matches to the pro standard, especially for up and coming players to get proper men's rugby experience. For me, kind of shaped how I play the game today and probably gave me an access point where I could show my abilities, because for probably periods of time it didn't look like I was going to become a pro, but you know, I think the AIL gave me a little bit of a platform just to sort of show what I was able to do.
You were thrown in the final last year against La Rochelle. What was the disappointment at the end of it like?
Yeah, it was probably my first taste of a proper loss. You know, I've been lucky to be in a few teams now where losing hasn't been an often occurrence, but you know, that's the one loss probably that's on the back of my mind, that, you know, we probably let that one slip, and it still hurts today. And I think, you know, you look at a lot of teams and the losses hurt you more than even you remember the losses, almost more than the wins. So yeah, it's brilliant that we get another shot at it this time in the Aviva as well. So I think it's exciting times, but, you know, we need to get our stuff right to get the job done.
Game on 2FM.
Rebecca Gray is still with me in studio. Rebecca, we do have a Premier League game to come this evening, Newcastle against Brighton. A bit of team news?
Yes, most definitely. Newcastle at home tonight with Nick Pope starting in goal, Kieran Trippier, Fabian Schär, Sven Botman, Dan Byrne, Bruno Guimaraes, I can never pronounce that, Joe Willock, Joe Linton,
better job than I would.
Miguel Almiron, Alexander Isak and Callum Wilson. Then for Brighton's starting lineup, we've got Steele and goal, Dunk, Gross, Welbeck, Undav, Mitoma, Casido, Gilmore, Van Hick, Estupinan and Buenanotte.
That's impressive, Rebecca.
Thank you. My Spanish in school stood well to me. But
I'm still practicing my Deserby.
We've got Ferguson and Moran, Jamie Mack, Moran, both on substitutions there for Brighton as well.
Okay, so sorry about that. Under 21 international Andrew Moran and Evan Ferguson, the great hope, as we keep calling him. Right, so that game gets underway a little bit later. And West Ham, every time you're in now, we're talking about West Ham, or we're looking at West Ham as well. They have the second leg of their Conference League game to come as well this evening. And they are 1-0 up, if I remember correctly.
2-1. 2-1. Pretty sure, yeah. 2-1 up.
Well, there you go. So lots of football going on away from kind of the likes of the Premier League and that. And I want to start with the FA Cup final last weekend, and just the crowd, 77,000 in Wembley for that Women's FA Cup final. Chelsea defeating Manchester United, winning their third FA Cup. Sam Kerr with the goal, as she often pops up within FA Cup finals. But Rebecca, as someone who regularly goes over to watch women's football and have been doing for quite some time, you must be just completely overwhelmed by the numbers attending games like this one.
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. I think it's just becoming second nature now, you know, when you talk about women's football, you know, you see the numbers rolling in. Amazing to see. Obviously, we've seen it again. I always go back to the Euros last year. I think that kicked off the whole kind of, you know, thousands upon thousands turning up to WSL games this year. Obviously, FA Cup finals, whenever it may be. Obviously, the El Clasico in Spain with Barca and Real with the 90-odd thousand at that as well. You know, football throughout Europe now for women is growing and growing massively. And it's great to see these numbers, you know, and hopefully it can keep on growing.
It's great that we have our own stars as well. Katie McCabe scoring for Arsenal last night. They beat Everton 4-1.
Yes, great goal. Great goal. She seems to only score good goals goals from distance. I was only talking to her yesterday before the game. I was like, get us a goal. So thankfully she did. And it was actually sad to see another injury for Arsenal there as well. So yeah, crazy all year.
Yeah, it has been. They've been through the ringer with those injuries. Pernille Harder is going to leave Chelsea. It was confirmed today. It was speculated for quite some time, as her partner Magda Eriksson has already announced that she is leaving. But lots of love for Pernille Harder today from Chelsea, including Emma Hayes. Everyone kind of giving their blessing. She's been a great servant to the club, and she's kind of been there throughout that growth of women's football. 29 now, still has a few good years left in her.
Yeah, she's still got a bit of playtime in her. You know, she's obviously had a hard run of it there. She had the bad injury, came back in. Obviously, was pretty influential when she came on in the FA Cup final as well. She links up really well with Sam Kerr, and you know, obviously linked up for the goal as well. So yeah, look, they're losing two amazing players. I think they're heading to Bayern Munich, as far as reports say. But yeah, great servants. I'm sure they've great memories there. But yeah, I'm sure they're going on to good things as well in Germany. Yeah.
Eriksson made 183 appearances, won 11 trophies for Chelsea since she joined in 2017.
Not bad.
Yeah,
not bad.
Absolutely. And then Harder came in 2020, but they just have been they have been such key figures over the last decade or so in the women's game, and watching it grow, and watching the just the increased coverage and the fact that, you know, we now have so much news around women's football. Transfers are becoming a big deal, and the stories, like, even just, you know, you hear now, like, when women's football stories are being written, like the fees that players are going for. Even Harder back in 2020, 250,000 was the move. So it's been great to see them playing for so long, and hopefully we'll see them playing for another while yet. While we're on the subject of progress, the draw for the Women's All-Ireland Cup was made in the FAI HQ today. 16 teams taking part, the first staging of the competition. Shelburne, of course, are in it, and they are going to be with Athlone Town, Galway United and Linfield in Group A. Then Cliftonville, Bowes, Derry City and Sligo Rovers in Group C. Glentoran are going to be in Group B with Piemont, Shamrock Rovers and Wexford Utes. That is quite a tasty group. Cork City, Crusaders, DLR Waves and Treaty United are in the fourth group. So that is going to be on over the summer. More games for all of these teams and just something more for people to keep following and keep interested in, Rebecca.
Yeah, definitely. It's great to see. I think it's something that's probably, you know, maybe overdue in a way. It might be something that we might see going forward, you know, in years to come in terms of the league itself. You know, that integration may happen. I'd say this might be somewhat of a trial run to see how the teams go against each other, you know, logistically, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, that group two is pretty much a group of death as well, isn't it? It's a tough one, all right. But yeah, I'm excited to see how it plays out.
Yeah, and I guess, look, with the World Cup coming as well, and we do have players playing for some of these teams, that it'll just be interesting to see from in terms of availability. Vera Powell has been quite vocal about her feelings on when players should be released, and I know we have spoken about it, but it seems like that there has been a little bit of movement, a few decisions made around that, Rebecca.
Yeah, so just obviously, you know, the teams are going to play up until that time, you know, before the World Cup kicking off. It obviously gives, you know, the likes of Vera, say, maybe that time to see girls still mm-hmm. playing, you know, in competitive games for a longer period of time in the women's national, or the League of Ireland women's Premier Division. You know, she'll see girls at Piemont, you know, obviously young Tara O'Hanlon got her run out there against America, you know, she'll mm-hmm. see her playing for a good bit of time. Obviously Abby Larkin at Rovers, you never know, there could be a few others that might spring to mind as she sees them, you know, closer to the time. So yeah, interesting to see how it plays out.
Do you think that anyone has a chance now of coming in?
Look, you never say never, you know. You've kind of seen what she's done over the last few months with the likes of Sinead Farrelly and, you know, obviously Aoife Mannion and Shiva and stuff coming in from the States. You really don't know what she's going to do. She very much plays her cards close to her chest, you know, and it would be interesting to see, you know, there's been girls that are there for long periods of time that haven't been getting a look in, you know, in the friendly games. So I don't know. I really don't know. Like, I was looking there, like the Jamie Finn and stuff, yeah. You know, in the friendly games, Amber Barrett, you know, they've been in the squads for a long time and she seems to have been favouring others, you know, above them. So look, I really, really don't know.
I'm going to ask you this question every week until you have an answer for me.
I know. Last week before they go.
Yeah, we might have some information.
Yeah.
Just on the games last weekend, a few big ones, and I guess the results are lots of, raised lots of eyebrows. Bowes scoring 3 goals against Wexford for the win.
Yeah, I think it's the first time they got points from Wexford ever, would you believe? Emphatic win from them, you know, and it was away from home in Wexford, which is not an easy place to go. It's just been a temperamental season for Wexford, you know. They had a bad run of defeats, obviously got the good win then against Shells, and then just seemed to slump again. But look, you have to credit Bowes, you know, they've worked hard since coming into the league, and look, they got their just rewards then, and were quite clinical against Wexford.
Piemont just keep grinding out these wins, like 1-0 against Treaty United, but like I said it at the start of the season, I didn't expect them to be doing so well. Like, I still can't believe they're doing so well, but look, they're getting the job done.
They are, you know, like, performances might not be top class, you know, at this stage of the season.
Results, but business.
Exactly. It's all about results, and, you know, they were down to 10 players from the first half. You know, Treaty could have scored a few goals in the second half. I was watching, I was kind of up and down off the chair thinking that the Treaty might get a goal, but yeah, look, Kate Mooney with the finish there and took the 3 points back to Dublin.
2-0 win for Shelburne over DLR.
Yeah, thankfully clinical in front of goal this week. Gemma Quinn got a brace. She's the number 9 there at the minute for Shell, so she'll be thankful with for that. You know, I think confidence has been a bit of an issue for her this season, but yeah, look, hopefully she can build on that now going forward, and another 3 points in Sligo this week.
And Shamrock Rovers, another win for them as well. 1-0 against Athlone Town, and look, it's a big one when you go down there.
Yeah. Again, like, we're only talking about this with the girls at Shells, you know, it's a very hard place to go at Lone. You know, the crowd get on your case. And again, Rovers, you know, Leo O'Leary's finish was fantastic again. She's done really well since going to Rovers. Yeah, again, great win. And they seem to have shown up against all the top teams, as they say. So interesting.
It's so competitive. at the top, and it, you know, it's a bit, it's actually quite kind of mirroring the Women's Super League. You know, there's a few teams up there, and it'll probably change a bit over the next few months, and it'll be hard to determine who's actually going to win. But Beaumont and Galway United might tell us a bit this weekend, anyway. Yeah,
they're fighting it out this weekend. Obviously, Galway coming to Dublin, they've not fared to, or they've fared well coming here already with the win at Shells as well. You know, so they'd be riding high with the results they've had. I think they're on level points at the minute with Shells, wide open, as you say. You know, Rovers are second there with Peas on top, so I'll be interested to see how that one goes. And obviously then we have Bowes and Athlone live on TG Cahir, which is another obviously great screen, and first time for Bowes as well being live on TV.
Okay, Rebecca, thank you so much. Stay with us though. I might get you just to keep an eye on any football news ahead of that West Ham game, and also the Newcastle one as well. We're going to take a very quick break now though.
Game on 2FM.
Hello, welcome back. I am delighted to say that Aoife Murray joins us now on the line to chat all things Camogie. How are you, Aoife?
Good, yeah, good.
Thanks for joining us. We're going to start with the off-the-field action, as we often do on these occasions, but there was a development in the Kildare story since we spoke last. So they've confirmed, Kildare that is, that they are not going to enter a team into this year's All-Ireland Camogie Intermediate Championship, but they are committed to an independent review to all matters pertaining to the preparation and participation of the county's Camogie teams. What are your thoughts on this, Aoife?
I suppose, look, the first place you go to is just disappointment, isn't it? It's disappointing that we have to talk about the off-field nearly every week, you know, and a thing like this, I think sometimes we forget that it's disappointing that they pull out of championship for 2023, but we have to think of maybe the older players within that panel. This might have been their last year, it might have been their last opportunity as well to represent their family and clubs at this level, and you know, you just don't know what could happen a player, and I think that's certainly where I would immediately go to. And two, I think it is an opportunity maybe for the county itself to take a breath, to understand maybe what the club players want, to understand what the club players want at an inter-county level, and even at a county board level, what do they want for Camogie within Kildare? I would certainly hope that that there is an independent review carried out pretty swiftly as well, Marie, because I know we're mid-May, but it would be nice to think that we could carry out a review, fully assess it extremely independently, and understand the workings behind it, so A, they can put that into action immediately, and B, so that when players do come back to the inter-county stage and prepare for 2024, they're doing so afresh with changes acknowledged, and not only acknowledged but put in place and implemented. And I think that's probably the biggest thing is, you know, fool me once, okay, but don't do it a second time.
Yeah, lessons have to be learned for sure. And I guess the only way we'll find out if they have is in time. And it's just a pity to see that a season lost to so many players. Let's move on to the action. And Tipperary beat Clare in the Munster final. And it's their first time winning in 13 years. I don't know why that's really surprised me, but it did.
And look, to be honest, and as somebody probably played out through a lot of those years, it surprised me as well, because I suppose they've always been thereabouts at Munster, and maybe not completely showing their ages, but growing up and playing in those probably early noughties, you know, Tipperary were so to the fore, like Pure Dave Somov. Yeah, look, and even, you know, some of those players to me, like Una Dwyer, one of the best fullbacks you'll ever see. I had the complete honour of playing with her one year at a Gaeling with Munster, and I saw her do things as a fullback, as a hurler, and I was just in awe. Obviously, I tried not to show that as a Cork woman, but to me, they had some of the finest hurlers that played Camogie, and seeing that it's taken them 13 years maybe to climb back up those steps with silverware, and immediately I suppose my head went to the likes of Cathal Van, Mary Ryan, and the amount of hours and mileage that they've put into, I have to say, as a Camogie person, I really was delighted for those two players in particular.
Yeah, and you could see how much it meant to them. I was watching an interview with Cathal afterwards, and she's just delighted to have something really to show for it, because it's so hard to win an All-Ireland, as you know, Aoife, that any bit of silverware along the way just makes that journey a little bit easier, I think. And look, Kilkenny then getting the job done against Dublin, and they are maybe the opposite end of the scale, and it's their 25th Leinster senior title. Yeah. And looking at the result and seeing the familiar names back, you'd have to think they're probably going to be a formidable force in a few months' time.
Yeah, but I think you have to give a little bit of credit to Dublin at how they went about that game. They brought Kilkenny into a bit of an arm wrestle. Mm. It's hard to do it, but I think even listening to Brian Dowling afterwards, using the words of "we found a way to win," that's a hard thing to train in a team. So I think he had to walk away with knowing that his players had, I suppose, the maturity on the pitch to find a way to win. Now, you look at Dublin and you'll go, okay, we're delighted that we brought into a fight and we nearly got there. However, you know, they'll look at that last goal that Julian Malone got. They had players, they had bodies in that square. They had enough players to deal with it. And they didn't. And I think it would be a little bit of a sucker punch for, I suppose, the positive work that Dublin did. It does go to show that when they come back out in is it 3 or 4 weeks' time, if they're able to tighten up those little decision-making parts and being a little bit more, I suppose, aggressive, you know, even giving away a free, even just giving away a penalty, trying to make that square a no-go zone. I think certainly there's learnings for them, but, you know, there was a huge amount of positive for Dublin out of that day.
Yeah, definitely. And look, they love those kind of games. They love, as Brian Dowling says, finding the way to win. And they, you know, will find out if the end of the season, if they'll probably reflect on those kind of hard battles, as they often do. Now, Aoife, there was an announcement today from the Camogie Association about their player welfare research findings. And it's really interesting, talking about playing time, inclusivity, burnout, menstrual cycle and squats. Mm-hmm. But we don't have time to get into it today. We will, though, hopefully get into it next week, because there's a lot of things that have popped up in it that found quite interesting. And Rebecca Cray's here as well. I'm going to just throw one stat at you, because I was captivated by it, that only 24% of players play camogie as their sole sport. So they play other sports as well, which I thought was quite an interesting one. I know you probably haven't had a chance to see it, Aoife, but was that something that you were surprised at?
Not necessarily, like, because it's like these things that, like, I'm even thinking back to when I played, like, you know, there's years there where I would have gone and played rugby for the winter. Now, poorly, but you know, A for effort, because I tried during the winter to stay in shape, but also just learn new things. You know, a new sport throws a lot at you. And then playing ladies football, you know, up in Bridget's in Dublin, and I would say if I was doing that and I was playing with Cork and inter-county level, you know, why wouldn't that be the case? And I certainly was always of the train of thought, the more sports you can play, you know, it's great to have one particular love with regard to sport, but I think there's nothing wrong with people playing multiple sports, as long as they're getting something out of it for themselves. So it didn't, I probably thought it would be a higher number, to be honest.
I'm from a village, like, you're from a village as well, but, like, there's nothing else there. So, like, we just played camogie because that was the only option that we had. And we're going to get into it next week, though, Aoife, because there's lots of interesting bits in it. And I think it does kind of capture a really broad perspective on women's sport in general. But for now, Aoife Murray, thank you so much. We're going to check back in with Greg Allen, who has been watching the US PGA opening day for us. Greg.
Yeah, things have changed since I was with you last. Improved greatly for Rory McIlroy. Brilliant. He's now one over par after 13 holes. He was 3 over when I was with you last. He holed an absolutely ridiculous putt from off the green on the 12th hole. It was very lucky. He even gave an expression of how did that happen.